minutes last time with this roll call for what I did dissent on that vote.
Which vote? Carlton, which vote was it?
It's on the fourth page of the notes from last meeting. At the top.
Okay, give me a second. You're talking about the recommended code change for the duplicate service?
No, the one prior. So it says motion passed by a roll call of vote of 6-0, John O'Hare absent. That passed 5-1.
I mean, I can double check the recording, but I'm pretty sure that you said I when your name was called.
Okay.
No, I mean, I will bring this up in the meeting, absolutely, so that the minutes don't get approved today.
Okay.
But I'll double check the recording.
Yeah, let's double check it, because
I did vote yes to the second one, but I did vote nay for that one.
Okay. Yeah, like I said, I
remember that, Dawn. I remember that vote also.
Okay. Thank you. But you do still need to bring it up in the meeting so that the minutes don't get approved today.
Sounds good.
They also could get approved with an amendment. It's up to how the chair wants to handle it. Yeah.
Chair won't be here today, so I think Dave is going to be leading the meeting today.
I believe the rules and regs say it's the longest serving elected member.
That's correct. Unless the chair made a special arrangement, but that's what the rules default to.
Would you like me to chair the meeting?
Sure. Is everyone here? I think we're...
I don't think so. Let's see. I don't see Dave.
Dave is not on.
And that's John and Sylvia with you, Lisa?
Yes. Okay. Let's go ahead.
Okay. So let's go ahead and call this meeting to order. Can we please get a visitor roll call for who is present?
Mark Rubin is absent. Dave Seymour is absent. Sylvia Alvarado, John O'Hare.
Here.
Terry Train.
Here.
Charlton Farron.
Present.
Angel Ozumalam.
Here.
And then Miss
And do we have a quorum?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Our next item on the agenda is the consent agenda approval. We have the May 2026 ratification report, the budget versus actuals, and the minutes regular meeting, April 23, 2026. One item on the regular minutes, Just a note that in the, I want to say second motion, regarding the employee's request, the notes I mentioned it was passed by a roll vote of 6-0. There was one dissent on that, so it's 5-1. Other than that, I know last time we waited on voting on the budget to allow staff to review and provide an update.
Yes, so I think that Dave Seymour was the one who had a question about it. Yes, and it was the way that the items, that the line items were grouped. So I think that the board needs to decide on the way that the lines are grouped. So I have them on grouped in a higher level, so in a more higher subject level. So if you want to see them in a more detailed level where it's by subject, by line items, I can do that. There's more going to be more lines. So I did see that in the past there had been, they had been a lot longer, that it had been more detailed. So it's just up to the board on whether they want to see it that way or if they want to see it more high level. So that's how I've been giving it to everyone in the past few months. So, but nothing was missing.
Any discussion from the board on this?
I'm talking about budget versus the financial report.
Yeah, at least giving it to as ledger level.
Yeah, I had the same questions because it's not lining up to the budgeted amount. It's mm-hmm. different categories. So is that going to be corrected for fiscal year?
It will. Mm-hmm. Yes. It wasn't, I don't know why it wasn't lined up for 26, but it will be for 27.
Yeah, I think next month is June, right? I think mm-hmm. we have 1 month of more detail so we can see actuals in a detailed line item so mm-hmm. that we can really see what's going on.
Okay, great. I can do that.
Okay. Any other discussion on the consent agenda?
Can I just clarify, are you going to keep that budget in the consent agenda or are we pulling that for again?
We're going to keep doing it, but I'm going to do it in further, in more detail.
Okay.
And the way that the budget and the expenditures are, they weren't lined up for this fiscal year, but they are for FY27. So they, so it's already fixed the matter that was, I think, at question.
So you're, can you do a reconciliation on 26 for the next meeting so that everything's
yes
clarified?
Okay. Do I hear a motion to approve the consent agenda?
So moved.
Thank you, John. Do I have a second?
Second.
Thank you, Sylvia. Will you please call the order or call the roll?
Mark Rubin. Dave Seymour, absent. John O'Hare.
Here.
Terry Train.
Here. Approved.
Charlton Perrin.
Aye.
Angela Zimbalong.
Aye.
And Sylvia Ambrano.
Aye.
Okay. So the consent agenda is approved. Is it five? With five firm? Mm-hmm. Okay. So our next item of agenda is the quarterly investment review with Callan. So they'll provide market update, go over our quarterly investment results. We'll discuss alternatives to Champlain. They've done some research and presented us with some options there. And then they have an item of corporate action related to Spirit Airlines and PIMCO. So with that, we'll turn it to Callan. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. You might be wondering why there are so many Callanites on the phone. before we get rolling with anything, did want to let you know that I have actually made the decision to step away from Callan and step away from work. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be taking some time off to spend with my family, my kids, just be a little bit more present for a while. And so this is actually going to be my last meeting with you all. I've certainly enjoyed the time, enjoyed the interaction, and you know, definitely wanted to be here to introduce you to the individuals that are going to continue to be supporting Gwen with you all. So with that, I'm certainly happy to take any questions on kind of what I'm doing, but if not, I'll turn it over to Jim Callahan, our president. So
great. Thank you, Craig, for your service, if I can just say that right away. And I'm sure the board, if anyone else on the board would like to mention anything.
Thank you, Donald.
Thanks.
Enjoy
thanks,
your time, Craig.
Thank you.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for the opportunity to join the meeting today. Thanks for the intro, Craig. And thank you for the work that you did with the system, and for Kirk Allen and all of our clients. We greatly appreciate it. We'll miss you. So as Craig said, we are going to try to replace Craig and support the system going forward. We know that, you know, anytime you have changes, it can be disruptive, but I can assure you that we're going to be laser focused on making this as seamless as possible for you. You know Gwen. She's worked closely with Craig on the relationship for a while and will continue to do so. I'm also introducing our colleague, Eugene O'Neill, who's based in our San Francisco headquarters, and Eugene is going to join the team. And I'm going to be present as sort of an executive sponsor going forward, frequently in contact with Eugene and Gwen on the relationship, and will be available as a resource to the board and to the staff as needed on a going forward basis. So I think we have a good plan. Again, our goal is to make this as seamless as possible. We're going to continue to work hard to make that come true. I'm not happy to answer any questions going forward, but I think we have a good plan in place, and we look forward to working with you going forward.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions from the board on that change? Okay.
So as my last gift to the team, I'm going to make them do most of the heavy lifting today. I will chime in, as needed, certainly, because I've got a little bit more background on some of this stuff, and we've worked together on this for a little while. So I think with that, let Gwen and Eugene roll through market and performance.
Okay. Gwen, do you want to take the lead?
Yes. Let me just get the right presentation up. Okay, can everyone see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so I'm going to start by going over the market update for the first quarter, beginning with the U.S. economy. GDP, we actually got updated numbers this morning, came in at about 1.6% in the first quarter. So compared to the fourth quarter, that was about 0.5%. So an increase there really driven by government spending as well as inventory investments. Consumer spending did contribute positively, but was a bit of a decline from what we saw from the fourth quarter. So I think that's just kind of showing that we were seeing a little bit of pullback from the consumer. Regarding labor markets, you know, the unemployment rate remained pretty flat and steady from the fourth quarter. Some of the rockiness that we were seeing in labor markets really had to do with the number of jobs added. As you may recall, last year, you know, we even saw job losses, and we kind of saw a little bit of volatility with the number of jobs added. So kind of some rockiness within labor markets. Inflation came in at 3.3% in March, and actually in April, it came in at 3.8%. So we're seeing an increase in inflation, and that was really driven by energy costs due to the close of the Strait of Hormuz and just the conflict that we were seeing between the U.S. and Iran. The Fed held rates steady in the first quarter at the target rate of 3.5% to 5%. In the beginning of the year, markets were anticipating potentially 2 rate cuts, and now markets are anticipating no rate cuts, just given the increase in prices that we've seen. There's a little bit of unknown here just because, you know, we do have the new Fed chair starting, I believe, next week. So kind of waiting to see where he wants to take rates. And then the Treasury yield curve at the bottom of the slide here, you can see the green line was the end of the first quarter. Rates rose across the curve, again, due to concerns regarding increases in prices. Looking at broader market performance now, so over the first quarter, you know, across different asset classes, it was a really tough quarter. Things started out pretty strong, but then, you know, once the conflict occurred, markets really pulled back. So within U.S. equities, you can see like a negative 4% return there, a small bright spot being a small cap. And then within non-U.S. equities, you know, a little bit better performance compared to U.S. equities, but still negative performance. Fixed income was essentially flat. One index I wanted to highlight was this commodity index here, returning about 24% over the quarter, again, driven by that increase in energy prices. However, looking at the one-year time period, you know, you're seeing really positive and strong performance across the board. Diving into a bit more detail, first starting with U.S. equity. So, you know, as I mentioned, the conflict between the U.S. and Iran really disrupted markets. What we also saw was I wanted to highlight the large cap space. There is a little bit of concern regarding, you know, the capital expenditures within the AI industry and the actual returns we'll see from all the investing into that space. And so within the large cap growth index, you can see here a negative return of about 10%. And then, as I mentioned, you know, small caps were a bit of a bright spot in performance. You can see the small cap value index returned 5% over the quarter. But again, so zooming out a little bit over the 1 year, really strong performance across the board. And then just to go into a little bit more detail about what's really going on within AI. So starting markets. And so essentially once ChatGPT was released, if you had any type of exposure to AI, you performed really well. So looking at this upper hand chart here. But then what we saw in the first quarter was that it was actually really dependent on what type of industry you had exposure to within AI. So essentially what that means is if you had exposure to power and metals and mining, as you can see here, you performed really well versus if you were a hyperscaler, so essentially the Magnificent Seven, or within software, you had negative performance. So it's not necessarily just a manager having exposure to AI means that you'll perform well. It really is dependent on where within that space you're performing well. So I think that just gives some helpful context about what's going on there, because I know that's just what everyone's been talking about recently. Looking at non-U.S. equity performance, you know, as I mentioned, it performed a bit better than U.S. equities. We saw some positive performance coming out of the UK as well as developed Pacific. One negative performer here that kind of stands out is India. That was really just, India is a big importer of energy and oil. And so because of those higher prices, we saw negative performance there. However, you know, over the 1 year time period, seeing really strong performance across the board for both developed and emerging markets. Moving on to fixed income, you know, returns were a little bit volatile, I guess, across the different sectors within fixed income. You can see here that those longer duration indices had negative performance. And that's, again, due to, you know, we saw rates rising and longer duration fixed income is more sensitive to rate changes. We did see, you know, those securitized indexes hold up over the quarter. They're a little bit less rate sensitive. One other thing I wanted to mention about fixed income was we did see credit underperformed corporate credit underperformed treasuries. So essentially, and that was due to spreads widening. And so what that means is investors were demanding more yield. And due to the inverse relationship between yield and prices, we saw poor performance coming out of corporate credit. Looking at private real estate performance, so you can see over the quarter, we had a positive return there, really driven by income, which has been pretty much the consistent theme over the previous time periods. Within the different property types, you can see here that appreciation within hotel was quite negative, but then regarding income, it was consistently positive across the different property types as well as the different regions. One thing I wanted to mention regarding the trends that we're seeing within private real estate. So this chart here is showing redemption queues, and we've seen a consistent decline in redemption queues. That's essentially the reason for this is, one, we're seeing a rescission in redemptions, and we're also seeing an increase in transactions. So redemptions are being able to be paid out. And then in this chart here, this is essentially looking at dry powder, which means committed capital, but capital that's not invested yet. And so we're seeing a decline in the dry powder, which essentially means, you know, there's more opportunities to invest, which is also why we're seeing an increase in transactions as well. So that's kind of the broader theme that we're seeing in private real estate markets. I did want to mention what we've been seeing since the end of the quarter, because I feel like a lot of things have changed since then. You know, March was a really tough month overall for markets, and then we pretty much saw a complete reversal in April. That was due to, you know, discussions of ceasefire and also renewed enthusiasm regarding AI, because a lot of the corporate earnings that were released surprised to the upside. So just to give you a number year to date, for example, the Russell 3000, which is a broader domestic equity exposure benchmark or index, year to date performance for the Russell 3000 is about 9.5%. So essentially all that pullback that we saw in March has essentially recovered. Yeah, so those are my comments regarding the market update. So I can pause if there are any questions.
Okay. Any questions from the board? I did think it was pretty notable the difference between the Russell value and the Russell growth for that quarter. I don't think you see that very often, but it does kind of show, at least in my view, some of the weakness that some of the growth has in certain environments.
Yeah.
It might be worth noting that within growth, there has been, since the quarter end, there has been a swing the other way. So I believe year to date, it's now positive 3. So in a relatively short period of time, a swing from, you know, down 10 to positive 3. Just a very choppy market, very headline driven.
Yeah. I feel like that's been really consistent with what we've seen in market performance, even over the past year, just very reactive to headlines and then recovery quite quickly after. With that, I can move on to performance. Okay. Can you all see my screen?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay, so this quarter we decided to put together an executive summary. So I know typically when we review the performance, we go over the performance report. I think an executive summary is a little bit more digestible. And so we'll be covering asset allocation, peer comparisons, total fund returns, attribution, and individual manager performance. And then we'll just flag anything that warrants attention or action. So starting off on this first slide here, we're looking at the asset allocation. So you can see the actual weight versus the target weight. Overall, you know, everything is within IPS guidelines within the min and max ranges of the targets. Largest asset classes are domestic equity, international equity, and fixed income, but no rebalance concerns at this time. This slide here looks at your asset allocation compared to peers. So the peer group that we're looking at is the Cowen Public Fund Sponsor Peer Group. Kind of explaining this chart a little bit, so you have your actual asset allocation on this line here, and then the target asset allocation on this line here. This gray, so essentially what we just looked at on the previous slide, this floating gray bar is how members within the peer group are invested, so essentially the weight ranges of those peers, and then this percent of group invested line at the bottom of the page tells you what percentage of peers are invested in this asset class. So this is really just like contextual, so you can kind of see what other people are doing who are, or what other plans are doing that are similar to you all. Overall, you know, you're well within peer ranges. One thing I'll highlight is this international equity allocation. So you can see you have a bit of a higher allocation to international equity compared to peers. And then for diversified real assets, only about 29% of peers are invested in this asset class, but you're right at the peer median. So you're not an outlier within the group of plans that are invested in that space. So no suggested changes coming out of this slide. It's just more for context.
Yeah, and I think I might add really quickly, what it also can help do is put into perspective how you're ranking relative to peers. So in periods where non-U.S. equity has been underperforming U.S. equity like we've seen pretty frequently, that can be a relative detractor when you're looking at some of the peer group rankings. You know, you all have generally been very ranked very highly relative to peers because overall performance has been good. But this can also help to put that into context a little bit when you are looking at some of those numbers.
Yeah.
Is it a concern at all that our cash is so low? I mean, I know we want to be invested where we can, but is it good to have any buffer there or no?
I don't think that's concerning that you would have a zero allocation to cash. I don't know if anyone else has any opinions regarding that, but I feel like it's typically uncommon to see dedicated cash target.
Yeah. Okay.
That's correct. Yes. And you have a very liquid portfolio, so in the event there is cash needs, you can raise.
Looking at the asset distribution slide now, so essentially what this is showing is your market value and weight across different asset classes and managers from the end of the fourth quarter to the end of the first quarter. Total market value was about $1.09 billion at the end of the first quarter compared to the end of the fourth quarter of about $1.1 billion. This decrease was due to net outflows of about $6 million and negative investment returns of about $17 million. However, you know, you can see here that some of your managers did return positive numbers over the quarter, which kind of helped alleviate some of that, those negative returns that we were seeing across other managers. One thing I wanted to highlight on this page was the JP Morgan Strategic Property Fund and the JP Morgan Income and Growth Fund. So you're 100% in the queue for the Income and Growth Fund because, as you all know, you're exiting these two managers and entering Harrison in principle. So you're 100% in the queue for the Income and Growth Fund, but then for the Strategic Property Fund, you're only in about 20% of net asset value in the redemption queue there, and that's in order to get a fee discount. Once this fee discount ends, you'll want to go 100% in the redemption queue, kind of explaining why you're seeing a bit more market value within this fund compared to the other fund there.
Okay. I did if you don't mind going back, yep. I just wanted to spend a minute on the large equity. I mean, I know that year to date, we do see a different story. But, you know, several months ago, I did mention a bit of concern of our balance in large cap equity and just kind of portfolio wide. I think that this quarter is kind of an indication that T. Rowe Price is a weak spot when the market goes down in certain regimes. And one thing I've been trying to push for is a little bit more defensive posture for the portfolio. And with that, you know, you have to weigh the upside and the downside, but I do see a lot of downside potential with some of these actors. And I just wanted to mention that, you know, I think there is if we want to increase our defensive, posture, that would probably be a good place to start is kind of examining our allocation there.
So to be clear, looking at that split, value versus growth, and seeing how those two trade off is that what you're asking? Just to be
yeah.
clear.
Yeah. Okay. So we had the conversation earlier this year. And, you know, if you remember back, and this will be similar to when we, you know, talk about the Champlain, potential Champlain replacements a little bit later, we're really looking for broad asset class exposure. Not necessarily looking to tilt one way or another, because we would say, you know, we're not necessarily great at timing. We're good at the long term, not at getting all the short term moves. And so the idea and the intent behind that allocation in large cap has to be roughly even with the overall exposure to the Russell 1000. It's consistent with what we've been trying to do in the small and mid cap space as well. I think when we reviewed the asset allocation, we did look at de-risking the portfolio, potentially pulling from equity, putting further assets in fixed income to de-risk from that perspective, because you might get a little bit more bang for your buck in terms of the absolute volatility of the portfolio. But that, you know, that's certainly something that could be revisited down the road.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Eugene.
Yes, we'd be happy to revisit. There has been a lot of talk, especially in the large cap space where concentration is becoming, quite extended. You know, the Russell 3, I think, NVIDIA is about 7.3% of that now. So it's quite a concentrated, market. You know, you can look at other alternatives. There has been some discussion of, you know, equal weighting benchmarks to remove that, but then you're taking on you're taking very specific bets other than what's going on in the broader market.
Right.
And the timing, as Craig mentioned, is really what it's about.
Yeah, and I don't think we need to obsess about, you know, trying to get the timing right, but it's more reading the broader market of, you know, long term. I just think, you know, this was a hiccup in the large cap. What if it was more than just a hiccup, right? It's kind of hard to recover from major losses when they show up. So just a thought.
Certainly.
Any other comments from the board before we move forward?
On this next slide here, we're looking at the cumulative returns of the fund compared to the target. So essentially, you can see that the fund, and this is over the 10-year time period, you can see that the fund is doing its job, it's outperforming the target, and these numbers at the bottom of the page here are looking at this at an annualized return number. So over the 10 years, you're seeing about 8.9% return compared to the benchmark of about 8.1%. And so on this slide, we're kind of looking at that in a little bit more detail and comparing it against the same peer group that I discussed earlier. And so over the last quarter, you know, we're seeing a bit underperformance compared to the target. However, as I just mentioned, you know, over the last 10 years, we're seeing strong performance and ranking in the top quartile compared to peers. Even over the last year, ranking 9. Which is really good. On this slide, we are looking at performance attribution. So essentially, this is allowing us to look at manager effect versus asset allocation effect. Manager effect is telling you, okay, did your managers in the lineup, was their stock or security selection additive or did it detract value? Then asset allocation essentially tells you if you deviated from the target, did that help or hurt? So over the last quarter, you can see that the main driver of this underperformance came out of the manager effect from the small and mid-cap equity space. And this was mainly driven by Champlain's performance, which I know we're actively in the search or put together search materials for you, which Eugene will cover in a second. And then over the one-year time period, you can see that the outperformance is really driven by the asset allocation effects, specifically within real estate. What this is telling you is essentially because you had a lower weight in real estate compared to the target, and because this was a slightly underperforming asset class over the time, you know, that was additive to performance, not necessarily encouraging tactical or timing asset allocation at all, just essentially telling you that, you know, this deviation was beneficial to performance over that time period. And then looking at the lineup now, so I'm just going to highlight a few different funds. So I know you Tarleton just mentioned the T. Rowe Price Large Cap Growth Fund. You know, we did see some underperformance there over the last quarter in the last year. And that's really similar to Eugene's points, is that this fund is highly concentrated. And just because we did see this space get hit quite hard, we were seeing pretty negative performance there. And just due to the high concentration of bets that this manager is making. One other thing to note is that this fund did implement a manager change, a portfolio manager change. And so that's just something we want to monitor, because essentially you're having a new portfolio manager come in and run the strategy. So we'll continue to monitor that. Champlain, you can see here, just performance has really struggled over these different time periods. Yeah, just wanting to highlight that. And I know we have a search going, so won't spend too much time there. I guess I know we had this in one of the items for the PIMCO Spirit Airlines, so I guess we can circle back to that for you, Jamie. Sorry?
Real quick, for the international, I noticed it's an American Century that outperformed the index quite a bit. Do you have any indication of what they did different this quarter or what may have led to that?
I actually don't have notes on that, but I can easily look at that after and follow up with notes for you on that.
Just found it notable that they were kind of a positive outlier. Yeah.
Yes, definitely a bright spot in the lineup for the last quarter in the last year, which is great. And then finally, looking at real estate, you know, as I mentioned before, we had the J.P. Morgan Strategic Property Fund and the J.P. Morgan Income Fund moving out of those. One thing I did want to mention is that the J.P. Morgan Income and Growth Fund, they're actually winding down this fund. This is the one you're 100% option queue for, so there's no additional paperwork required. But what I did want to say is that you are getting a fee discount because they're winding down this fund. So essentially, starting in the second quarter of 2026, so already implemented, until the end of 2027, you're getting a 30% fee discount. And then after that, you'll be getting a 50% fee discount. Okay. So that was one thing I wanted to highlight regarding that fund.
And so I think it's important to know, from an asset allocation perspective, you would expect the income and growth fund to pay back a little bit more quickly. And when the initial commitments were made to both Harrison Street and Principal, only 50% of the intended commitment amounts were done. So new commitments to get to the full amount. Initially, it's supposed to be $60 million total. $30 million has gone to each of those. So that will need to be updated as money continues to flow back from income and growth. And then I guess maybe really quickly while I've got the mic, American Century stock selection was extremely favorable in information technology. So that was one of the key drivers that they saw for the quarter. So names that they held for quite a while outperformed relative to what the rest of the non-US market did.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Craig. Okay. With that, I will pause if there are any questions. Otherwise, I can pass it over to Eugene to go over some of the search materials that we prepared for Champlain.
Any questions from the board on the quarterly performance?
Okay, so maybe before Eugene gets rolling with the actual search, I'll give him a second to pull it up. You know, maybe just as a quick reminder, Champlain has been in the portfolio for 15 years. They've been a complement to the Fidelity Small Cap product. To give you all roughly Russell 2500 exposure. So when we had talked the last time we were in front of you, we were going to take a look at additional options in the mid-cap equity space to replace Champlain. When we went back to our research folks, there were a lot of discussion ensued about the intent of the allocation, where it fits. And it comes out that we don't have a lot of conviction in a lot of active mid-cap equity strategies right now. And so to make sure that you all had, you know, some of our best thinking in front of you right now, we have both a couple of mid-cap options as well as what are called SMID options. So the SMID options that you have in front of you, you know, have both mid-cap and small-cap exposure. But one of the things that we looked at, even with those options, was how they complemented that existing Fidelity strategy. And so when Eugene goes through the material, you're going to see some differences in the candidates in terms of implementation, market cap approach, and things like that. That is really the nuance between the different candidates, is a couple of them are pure mid-cap, a couple of them are SMID cap. But what we did was we looked at, if you maintain, you know, the roughly 50-50 allocation between whatever the new manager is and Fidelity, that you get to that Russell 2500 exposure. And so all of the candidates get you to that exposure level, even though they do have different implementations and approaches, and they are not all pure mid-cap. And so I do want to pause for a second, because I will say that it is a complication and a nuance based on, you know, what we had originally discussed, and certainly happy to take any questions on that, though.
Oh, great. Thank you for explaining that.
Okay, great. So I'll let Eugene roll.
Okay, great. Maybe I'll take a few seconds just to introduce myself. Eugene O'Neill, I'm a senior vice president on Cowen's West Coast consulting team. Just want to reiterate what Jim and Craig have said. I'm looking forward to making the transition as smooth as possible. Really looking forward to working with you, and excited about what we can do together. So with that, I will present the mid-cap equity search that we have conducted on your behalf. Here we're going to present the semi-finalists. So as Gwen discussed, Champlain performance has really struggled. Its quality bias has been, you know, historically in the zero interest rate environments, it performed pretty well, but it has really struggled from 22 onwards, 2022, when rates aggressively rose. It has struggled in this new environment. I think it's particularly stark when you look at the sort of very buoyant mid-cap index, 3-year performance over the last 3 years, 13% versus low single digits for Champlain. As a result, looking at maintaining a split of 50-50 and looking for some candidates that would be complementary to your existing Fidelity exposure in the small cap. Again, Fidelity has done a pretty incredible job outperforming over all time periods. And now we're just looking to see. Sorry?
Oh, no, go ahead. Sorry.
Yep. Now we're just looking to see in the event you decide to replace Champlain, who could be a potential good fit. So moving on, we have identified two fundamental and two systematic managers. As Craig mentioned, you know, once you're looking at active, there isn't a lot of conviction there. We have identified two positive managers, I think, that we have conviction in, but also bringing in systematic to look at funds where systematic funds are typically model driven, i.e. the algorithm sets the buy and sell, as opposed to a fundamental process where a human is getting involved and looking at valuing the company from a bottom up level. We have two capitalization structures, MID and SMID. In both cases, they give you that broad exposure to the Russell 2500. So it does come out, although they're got different capitalization targets, it does come out in the mix that they give you that exposure of the Russell 2500. So the four targets we've identified. Ernest, this is your most concentrated option among your fundamental of the two. Typical holdings 40 to 70, very low turnover, about 15%. That concentration plus low turnover will mean you will deviate from the index a little bit. Longer term, we see this as a core manager, but over shorter time frames, they do exhibit some bias towards value. Very consistent process, typically weighted higher in the market cap peer group. So again, we'll pair well with that Fidelity offering.
Is that low turnover fairly typical for fundamental strategies, or is that
I think that's pretty low for strategies more broadly. The other fundamental strategy we're presenting today, I believe, is closer to 50% off the top of my head. So I think that's pretty low, especially, and it makes sense with the sort of higher conviction. Usually when you have a more concentrated portfolio, you know, there can be higher conviction, and then you're going to be less likely to churn the portfolio as the market evolves.
Okay.
Okay, Vanguard, this is one of your systematic options. Some things to point out here. Very diversified, systematic portfolios tend to have much higher number of positions. So here we're seeing about 350 to 500 positions. One thing to note is that the PM changed in 2021. Cesar Orozco joined. He has been sort of he's made a noticeable impact on sort of bringing it to the fore in terms of what's going on in the quant world. So he's implementing machine learning models. He's doing a number of things. One thing to note is that compared to other fund or systematic approaches, he will take a little bit more tracking error. We'll move things around a bit more based on factors. We'll see this more as we look at the exposure and how things change. But does vary, you know, he'll swing towards growth. He'll swing towards value, depending on signals in the market. Something to keep in mind there.
What's Callan's view on say momentum strategies and those kinds of things that are becoming more prevalent? Have you seen a lot of benefit from that?
I think in terms of their underlying approach, He will take factor approach as necessary, so may move in and out of momentum. Momentum has been, you know, pretty volatile. Towards the start of the year, you had some major momentum unwinds. Definitely there's, you know, momentum has recovered, but I think that's probably a better question for the manager in the event you bring them forward for interview. Okay. Moving on to Loomis, the other fundamental approach. Here we see, unlike the more concentrated approach of Ernest, we see 90 to 100 holdings, tighter max positions from a sector weight, tighter max positions overall. That's going to give you hopefully less tracking error than you're going to see from an Ernest. One thing to point out is that the PM, Joe Gatz, has been there for quite some time, and there has been no discussion of replacement or the sort of next bench of potential PMs that might step in the event that there's any change. But he does have a bench supporting him. We are starting to get to know that bench of portfolio managers supporting him. But we would say in the event that, say, for instance, Loomis did progress and was hired, in the event that Joe moved on or retired, we would be suggesting a replacement search, but just something to bear in mind. Moving on to T. Rowe Price. T. Rowe Price, this is probably more typical in terms of the tightness of tracking error you might see in a systematic approach. Highest number of holdings, very diversified, so 500 to 600. Lower turnover. Sorry, I misspoke when I said the 50%. That was, I was referring to T. Rowe. I'll double check the turnover of Loomis, but 15% is typically low for a fundamental process. What I would say on T. Rowe Price is they have an interesting approach. Oftentimes, systematic approaches will have certain blind spots for parts of the market that are quite difficult for quantitative models to in alpha. So what they do is they will take a combined approach. They have, you know, a huge bench of analysts supporting this program. So for instance, in sectors like biotech, REITs, etc., you will build in some of the fundamental in analyst insights and pair them with the overall algorithm to try and capture the market as a whole. I think that's an interesting approach.
Agreed, yeah.
So moving on, looking at the style map, the whole point, as Craig mentioned at the outset, was to get that broad Russell 2500. So when you look at a 50-50 split of Vanguard, Loomis, T. Rowe, and Ernest, you do get, you know, a number of them, Russell, Loomis, and Vanguard do get you very close to that Russell 2500. Ernest, obviously, being in a bit of an outlier, being higher in that market cap structure. Moving on to performance, I think for me the standout here is probably the consistency of T. Rowe Price paired with Fidelity. Over 1 year and longer, consistently, you know, at or about top quartile performance. Ernest, as I mentioned, you're going to see that tracking error. So looking at the performance in the top line, Ernest and Fidelity, you do see some movement, but again, long over longer time periods, near top quartile percent for both 7 and 10 years. Vanguard also, again, very consistently top quartile, so pairs well. Loomis, you do see, again, very good performance. But what I would say is with both of the fundamental managers, you see a little bit more or a bit less consistency in that top quartile performance. Looking at the single years, I think this is where it sort of shows that Champlain, how they did very well in a sort of lower and zero interest rate environment. Looking at them prior to that big bump in rates from 2022. So this is the fifth down on the bottom chart. Looking over 21 through 2017, you know, you had top decile performance in a couple of years, especially in that larger downdraft in the market in 2018. And again, keeping up with the strong markets in 2019 and 2021. So again, let's put this in a sort of broader terms. Let's look at it at risk, what risk you're taking for the return you're getting. Here we show over 5 years the returns versus the standard deviation or risk. The red, bright red shows you the Russell 2500. And what you see is here you want to be higher return. So in the top of the chart and lower standard deviation. So the return per unit of risk you're getting is better. What you see is compared to the index, T. Rowe, Loomis and Earnest, higher returns than the 2500 and lower or near the same as standard deviation or risk, as opposed to the Champlain, which is the incumbent, where you're taking on quite a bit more risk and not getting that benefit in terms of return, so a little bit less efficient. Over the longer term, 10 years, Champlain fares a little bit better, but compared to the potential replacements, all of them offer a sort of longer term return versus standard deviation trade-off.
And Earnest did pretty well there in T. Rowe price as well.
Yes, yes. I think Earnest over the 10 years stands out as being the best trade off in terms of return and risk. But T. Rowe price also, you know, I think they're all T. Rowe price, Loomis, and Earnest stand out pretty well there. Vanguard a little bit more risk. As I say, that PM change back in 21, so brings in about 5 years of performance. They're going to move things around a little bit more, but similar returns to the other three potentials. Now, this is, I suppose, where it gets more interesting. Here we're looking at the excess return versus the tracking error, how the fund deviates from the benchmark. What you're seeing is all of the proposed options in that top left corner, so positive, you know, T. Rowe standing out as being, you know, similar excess return to Vanguard, with only a small bit more tracking error. Earnest, again, this is over 5 years. Earnest, not as much in the excess return, similar levels of tracking error. This is where you can see the active or sort of fundamental process versus quant or systematic process having a little bit more tracking error. Over the longer term, again, I think T. Rowe price here stands out as, you know, the lowest on tracking error and, you know, very good, strong excess return. So it's always good to look at different rising and falling periods. So let's look at the declining period. And what you saw is if you look at Champlain, you didn't see that quality really protect them in the down market, 93rd versus the peer group. The rest of the potential replacements we have suggested were around mid-table with the exception of Loomis. Other periods, again, just to contrast, just to show that market environments change. And so strategies can go in and out of favor. Looking at the declining period in the second last column, you see Champlain in that down market performing pretty well versus the others. I will highlight, however, that looking at the potentials we have put forward, three of the four still in that sort of top half range.
Like Ernest did fairly well in down and up.
Correct. So looking at the peer groups, Ernest is sort of consistently in the top half. Ernest paired with Fidelity, I should say.
Yeah, true.
Loomis a little bit more moving around. T. Rowe stands out pretty consistently as being top half, with the same to be said for Vanguard. Here we look at market capture. So what you're looking for is a high number on the up market capture, i.e. are you capturing more upside when the market is really buoyant versus down market capture, the market's falling, you want to be capturing less of that performance. So higher number on the left column, lower number on the right column. And what you see is that T. Rowe stands out and Vanguard stand out both in that upmarket capture. That makes sense. They have a lot more exposure to the market. I mentioned the sort of hundreds of positions as opposed to 70 to 90 for the fundamental approaches. Again, down market capture, mid market for T. Rowe and Vanguard. In fact, they're all in and around median compared with, unfortunately, Champlain capturing more of that down market. Looking at it from a returns-based risks, if you look at the two columns labeled sharp and information ratio, sharp is the sort of ratio of the returns per unit of risk you're taking on. Over 5 years, all of our proposed replacements are top half to verging on first quartile. Information ratio, again, this is for the 50-50 split. This is where you're looking at your excess return versus your tracking error as a statistic. T. Rowe and Vanguard both stand out pretty well there, being top quartile and in fact top decile for Vanguard. Finishing up, I think we've put forward four, you know, credible replacements. Here we look at fees. Of the fees, I think Vanguard and T. Rowe stand out, obviously, and propose, you know, it would be quite a significant fee saving of 16 basis points all in, sorry, 17 basis points all in for the Vanguard and 43 all in for T. Rowe, although both Ernest and Loomis would offer fee savings relative to your current fee. My understanding is that these are not best and final, so there may be some room to benefit from here. Yeah, some room to negotiate. So with that, I will open up for discussion.
Well, maybe really quickly, you know, past practice for the board has been to invite candidates in for interviews. You don't necessarily have to do that as part of best practice, but that is historically what the board has done. So I think what we're looking for from you all is, you know, one, do you want to do interviews? And then if you do want to do interviews, which of the candidates would you like to invite in? And certainly, to Eugene's point, certainly happy to have some additional discussion on that if there are questions for going that route. So.
Okay, I'd like to open it up for a discussion for the board.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Craig. Just for interviews in the past, Craig, I feel like the board typically would bring in at least two of the candidates. Do you have, is that consistent with what you'd expect?
Yeah, so since I've been working with the board, I think I've been a part of two or three searches, and we've had between two and four candidates, depending. But if you were going to do interviews, we would suggest at least two.
Okay.
So you can see the comparison between them.
The benefit of having a third, I think sometimes, is that when you have just two, in the event that, say, one presenter doesn't bring their A game on the day, then you're not sort of choosing by default just because one did not do well. Broadening it out, I think, sometimes gives you a little bit more flexibility to really pick the one that you want, but happy to be said by the board.
Yeah, we've definitely seen those those kind of presentations before, so that's a good point.
Yeah, I'm conscious of that. You don't want to choose the least bad option. You want to choose the option that you're really happy with.
Yeah. Maybe to say, we think these are all good options. Sometimes they have off days when they're presenting.
Exactly. That's why I say it, just in case they don't bring their A game on the day. I think the numbers speak for themselves. I think, you know, these are all managers that our research team are very happy with, that they've done due diligence on. It's purely a case of just if you, anything can happen on the day, I guess, is what I'm saying. And I had heard that previous presentations, there had been one or two where there have been struggles.
Based on the information presented, my top two picks are Vanguard and T. Rowe Price. And Loomis is probably my third. But I'm open to suggestions on feedback on if Ernest should be brought in or not, or instead of one that I've.
I think three gives you a lot. It also, the benefit of going three versus two in this instance is that it'll give you a systematic and a fundamental approach. So with that said, happy to be said by the board.
I had a question also. This is only my second meeting, so I haven't been involved previously, but has Champlain been brought in to kind of explain their performance?
Yes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they presented, what was it, the February meeting? January or February meeting to the board.
So I'd like us to bring in two. Ernest, I think, would be my top pick, and then Hero or Price. Our deferred comp plan is heavy and T-Row Price.
Okay.
So we sort of know that.
Yeah.
So those two, T-Row Price.
So you would lean towards Ernest and T-Row Price?
Yes.
Other discussion from the board? We still have quorum, correct? Since Terry had to leave.
Well, we have.
Yeah, we do.
Yes.
Okay, just making sure.
Yes.
So I would kind of lean also towards T. Rowe Price, Vanguard, and Loomis were kind of mine. But I think it'd be fine to hear from, I'd say, at least three. And since we have someone interested in Ernest, I'm okay with listening to all four as well, just to get a full view of it.
Yeah.
I would suggest that we bring in all four.
Okay. Excellent. Do I have a motion that we, is that a motion that we would need to do, or just direction?
That would be a motion. And then, so I've not been there. How do we normally do the interviews? Do we bring them in for
the official? Callan will arrange it, and it'll often be online, or they can be in person, depending on.
Is that usually in person?
So we've done them both ways, both in person and virtual. I think that's really at the discretion of the board. Okay. Typically what's happened when you've done interviews is we've then worked with whoever's been sitting in your seat, Lisa, to determine the amount of time that everybody gets, just to be cognizant. These meetings tend not to be more than a couple hours. If you're bringing in all four, and you give them all 30 minutes apiece. That's 2 hours of meeting time right there. And so just we've historically worked with you all on the board in terms of how long and how you do them in person or virtual. So I do think the last slate was virtual because over the last 3 or 4 years, your only in-person meeting has really been that board retreat.
So. Right. Right. Okay, so the virtual probably would be best, yeah.
Would anyone like to entertain a motion or provide a motion to invite all four?
Umu.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, thank you, Angel. And,
all right. So Mark Rubin, absent. Dave Seymour, absent. John O'Hare?
Oh.
No, does
that
fit? Okay.
Sherry Train is absent. Tarleton Farron?
Aye.
Angela Zumalan?
Aye.
And Sylvia Amparano?
Aye.
Motion's passed.
All right, motion passes for affirming. Okay. Thank you for that presentation on Champlain.
And next up, it's actually a duplicate, so I apologize. But it's a duplicate of the one we just covered.
The PIMCO?
We just noticed that it was the D.
No, no.
And D.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We still have
the next one. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
So maybe a very quick question for the board based on some of the discussion that was had the last time we presented. And based on the motion, I think I know the answer to this, but just want to be clear. There's no interest in continuing to move forward with Champlain at this time. Or is that still on the table? Is there anything the board wants to see or hear from them at this point or go through with the interviews and then make the decision after that? Just so we're clear on course of action.
Discussion from the board?
I have heard everything I wanted to hear from them for about 15 years. So I think it's time to.
Okay,
cool.
Thank you, John.
Angel? I would say let's conduct the interviews first and then we can decide.
Okay. Yeah, I think where we had left off is that we were going to keep the investment with them until we found suitable candidates and then decide from there.
No, that's right, because we had included them in the book as a comparator, so I just wanted to be clear what the board's expectation was from that. So I appreciate that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Do you want to proceed with the PIMCO item?
Sure. So I guess I'll take this quickly. You guys might have heard that Spirit Airlines declared bankruptcy. They're no longer operating their business. So as part of that, PIMCO was holding some Spirit Airlines warrants inside of their portfolio, which is allowable by the guidelines. Those warrants were converted into equity, which are not technically allowable by the guidelines. It's $8,100 worth of warrants. Because of the volatility and the uncertainty of where that equity sits right now, PIMCO doesn't want to be forced to sell it. So they were looking for an exception to be able to hold that equity until an appropriate time where they can dispose of it. Like I said, it's only $8,100, so the dollar amount is very, very small. But because it is not allowable in the guidelines currently, it's something that needed to be brought to the board's attention. So they didn't buy it. They got it because of the corporate action on the warrants.
Right. Do I have a motion to approve PIMCO's proposed action? Do I have a second? Thank you, John and Sylvia. Can you please take the
read? Mark Rubin, absent. Dave Seymour, absent. John O'Hare?
Aye.
May I please open for discussion here for a moment, if you don't mind? Craig said that our policy does not allow it. So what is the motion seeking to do?
It's to allow PIMCO to continue to hold that equity contrary to the board's policy until they determine that it's the appropriate time to sell it or otherwise dispose of it.
Yeah, maybe to clarify on the policy, it's PIMCO's specific manager guidelines. Because PIMCO is a separate account, it's in the PIMCO guidelines that it doesn't explicitly say they can hold equity. So it's to allow that exception there. It's not the broad overarching TSRS IPS.
That's understood.
Thank you for that, Angel. Appreciate it. Okay. Any objection, or is it okay if we proceed with the vote? Any further discussion? Okay, great. Go ahead.
Okay. Mark Rubin absent. Dave Seymour absent. John O'Hare.
What was the motion? I'm sorry.
For PIMCO to go ahead and hold on to the 8100 until they deem to dispose of it.
Okay.
When they are able to. Okay.
Aye.
Okay. Terry Trade is absent. Charlton Perrin.
Aye.
Angela Zamalam.
Aye.
And Sylvia Barama.
Aye.
Motion passes.
Okay, great. And then any further discussion on the quarterly investment review? Or items from Catalina on that? So I think the only main action item pending from that is just kind of that review of the portfolio, and further discussion on that when we kind of reconvene. When do you think we can have that, an update on that?
I can get working on that for the next board meeting. That would be the.
In June.
And Mr. Chair and Lisa, oftentimes the board meeting, one of the summer board meetings is canceled for lack of agenda items, and that might give us a good window to do interviews. And I think that's usually the July meeting. But Lisa, you might want to take a look at the next couple months.
Yeah, the next one is June 25th and July 23rd. So I will take a look at what is supposed to normally come around those months. All right, I will let Callan know.
Any other items? Okay, thank you, Callan, for that market update and all that. We really appreciate it. And Craig, again, on behalf of the entire board and TSRS staff, just thank you for your service and for the great assistance that you and Kellen have provided for us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, well, thank you all. I'll definitely miss doing this, so it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Craig.
Thanks, Craig.
Thanks, Craig.
Nice to meet the new additions also.
Yes.
Looking forward to working with you.
Looking forward to it.
V is a repeat of C3, so excuse us while we,
nope.
Accident. So then we just move on to E.
We can move to item E of the agenda, proposed mm-hmm. code changes. Here we will discuss the prohibition against double service credit, small refund balances, and employee contribution rates.
Mm-hmm. So I think Cassie's going to be covering this a little bit, but okay. We'll be covering the transfer service credit, which adds a non-duplication rule to prevent members from receiving overlapping pension service credit from multiple Arizona retirement systems. And then we'll be covering small refund thresholds. So this increases the automatic IRA rollover threshold for terminated non-vested members from 5,000 to 7,000
And the third one is the member contribution rates, which updates code language to allow the city to hold member contribution rates flat and pay any difference through additional employer contributions. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Would you like me to share the screen, Lisa?
Please.
Okay. Okay. And I want to be clear on some of these changes because, there's a couple items redlined here that the board has already approved, but they're, I'll explain it as we go. So as Lisa mentioned, the first change deals with the potential for duplicate service credit that the board has dealt with in the past couple of meetings. And we have provisions in the code that allow service credit to be transferred from ASRS or other state pension systems. And that credit is, the transfer process is liberal, as long as it does not create a detriment to the system in terms of the financial obligation for that service credit. So what I'm proposing is that we amend that transfer rule to clarify that any transfer from ASRS or one of the other systems in the state would not be allowed if the individual member is already credited for the same time period under TSRS. And that's the situation we had before. And the board may remember that we already have language in the code that prevents duplicate credit for two different periods of employment or two different employment positions with the city. This arose only because of an individual who worked for the city and for an outside entity covered by the state system at the same time. So I feel like the other potential areas where this dual employment could occur are already covered in the code. And this is our gap in the code is specific to the transfer situation. So the new language simply says that a transfer will not be accepted by the system if it would result in service credit for a period of time that the member is already credited under the system.
Correct. Any questions from the board on this language? One thing I had to reread twice was that last part. So the proportional part of 1 year, mm-hmm. that just means, you know, if they serve 6 months, that also includes, you know, or it's less than a year.
But that's correct.
Just took me a second to understand it. Any further discussion on this before we entertain a motion? Angel, did you? No?
No.
And I think if the board prefers, we can do one motion for all three of these code updates when we get through them. Okay. The next one, this is a very small clarification. So we do have provisions. These are IRS approved provisions in the code that state that when a member leaves a small refund balance behind when they terminate from the city, we have basically a force out provision that says amounts below $5,000 can be forced out to an individual retirement account, an IRA, maintained for that individual so that the balance is not held in the system. This only happens if the member is not already requesting their refund or responding to correspondence from staff about taking their refund. And previously, the board has already approved the increase in that small account, small refund force out provision from $5,000 to $7,000.
Okay.
So that's already approved, but it hasn't gone to mayor and council yet. The change here is that our current rule is bifurcated. The current rule says that if the small refund is valued at $1,000 or less, the member is paid out with a check, a cash distribution that's taxable. And if it's between $1,000 and $5,000, it is sent to an IRA. The proposed change today is to say that all of these small refund amounts will be sent to an IRA. So someone with a refund balance of $700 would be sent to an IRA. And our hope is that that will lessen the number of checks that don't get cashed or people that, you know, can't be located. Because the IRA provider that contracts with the system will take those balances and will continue to search for the person, even if the initial address information is not correct. So this hopefully will streamline the administration on these very small account refund balances.
Excellent. Any items of discussion from the board on that proposed change?
Question. Oh, sorry. I was listening. I was trying to read while I was listening to you, Counselor.
Sorry, Jen. Go ahead, Jen.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was trying to read while I was listening to you. If the balance exceeds 7,000, if the balance does not exceed 7,000, I'm trying to read, what happens?
If it does not exceed 7,000?
Uh-huh.
Then it's going to be sent to an IRA custodian who will set up an IRA in the member's name, and the member then owns that money inside the IRA. So they are given information to say your money has been moved from TSRS to an IRA. Here's the contact information for the IRA. And the reason for that is it lessens the board's fiduciary responsibility to manage that money. It takes it off of the books of the system. If the balance is more than $7,000, generally the IRS says that the money can't go into these force out IRAs. So that's a distinction set by the IRS. But the system under state law also has a provision that says if somebody is not in contact and can't be located for a period of 3 years, that money will escheat to the state.
Gotcha. All right, understood.
Okay.
Do anything 7,000 or less will be turned over to an IRA. Anything more than 7,000 will send it as unclaimed property to the state.
Right, and if the member is in contact with the system and they have more than $7,000, it will sit for their benefit. So the escheat only happens if the person is quote lost.
John, you had a comment?
But those funds, when they escheat to the state holds them for a number of years. I'm not sure what it is, like 10 or 20 or 40
for
years.
For the same property.
Which is wild.
Okay, any further discussion on this item from the board? I think it's clear.
Okay. And then the next item deals with the city setting the member contribution rates. And Lisa also included an excerpt from the city manager's memo on the budget process. And so it's my understanding, and Lisa, jump in and correct me if I say anything incorrect, but for the upcoming fiscal year, the city manager did not recommend the increase in member contributions. So he is recommending in the budget, and I think the budget is done at this point, that the member contribution rates again stay flat in light of the fact that the city is continuing to fund the employer contribution at the 27.5% rate under the funding policy, which means that there is excess funding going in over the actuarial recommended rates. And I do have another comment on that, but Angel?
Thank you so much. The city manager's concern was that we were proposing to increase employees' contribution without a proposal to decrease the city's contribution.
So, yes, thank you. I did notice that, and I think that's an important point for the board to discuss and ultimately provide some feedback to the city manager on that, because the reason that there's an increase proposed or recommended for the member rates as well as the additional funding on the employer side is code driven. So it is set up under the code to be two separate determinations.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so this provision of the code that we have up on the screen is the member contribution rate calculation, and it is based solely on the employee segment normal cost, which, as the actuaries explained, that is the cost of benefits earned each year. And the member contribution rates are, under code, supposed to be at least 50% of the employee segment normal cost. So that's a separate calculation that is run independent of what the city's contribution is. And that's why there's always two separate recommendations, one for member rates, one for the city's rates. And so this language here is intended to put a long-standing exception into this code language to say that beginning a couple years ago, July 1, 2025, the city may determine that the member contribution rate should not increase because they recognize that the employer contribution rates are sufficient to cover the funding for the year. So I think that we get to the same place, but we're coming at it from different directions. The board is making recommendations based on two calculations under the code, two separate calculations under the code. The city manager is taking the more practical view as this is two pieces of one pie, right? So I just want to make that distinction so that, you know, you're all up to speed on that, the reason for the board's separate recommendations when it gets to the manager's office or to mayor and council. So
go ahead and finish, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say the board recommendations line up with the code language. And ultimately, you know, it might be the kind of thing that the city wants to look at and say, well, let's change how the code requires these calculations to be done then, right? That is a possibility as well. You know, this current calculation rate was put into effect in 2006. It has changed over time, and it may be appropriate to change it again. But this will work in the interim. This revision will allow either the manager or mayor and council to say, no, we're going to forego an increase on the employee side because we're continuing to fund over and above on the city side.
Just a few questions here. One, it says effective July 1st, 2025. Was that mm-hmm. intentional to be retroactive? Okay.
It is because the city has held the rates flat for a number of years now. And so what we were doing initially, you'll see in this black language at the bottom, we were doing annual amendments to this provision. And then working with the city attorney's office a couple of years ago, we said, let's just put in a catch-all that the city can use when they want to hold flat. And this hasn't gone to mayor and council yet. So we want to package this with the other pending code changes and get everything to mayor and council for approval.
And then my second question is, what we're saying here is because the city has exceeded their recommended contribution rate by more than what, you know, the recommendation for the employee increase is, then it's okay.
Okay. That's right. That's right. And the city has exceeded by far more than the increase in the member contribution rates.
Okay. So this last item open for discussion for the board.
Okay. And again, there is a note here that this language in the center of the section has already been approved by the board, but it hasn't gone to mayor and council. So this is the newest revision that because what we're seeing is there aren't necessarily formal documented decisions on the member contribution rates. They are built into the budget. So I want to just be more specific about how that approval gets done. Okay.
Any questions? So, discussion?
I guess just I want to make sure that there's no negative actuarial result on this, right? So are we just deferring it? Are we pushing things off for the benefit of those employees and those select tiers for budgetary purposes? Not necessarily for budgetary purposes, because the city contribution doesn't change.
That's a good question. Yeah. So what you'll hear at the retreat is the actuaries are, the member contribution rates are falling behind the recommendations under this provision each year. So there is a cumulative effect that's building. So and these numbers are not accurate, but if the members are contributing 6.25%, over time, with all of these decisions to hold them flat, the actuarial recommendation might be 6.75 or it might be 7. So the gap between the actual rate for the members and the recommended rate is growing because of these annual determinations. But on the other side of the equation, the city is funding substantially more than its recommended rate. So if the city's rate, for example, is 21% on the actuarial calculation, they're funding at 27.5%. So what the board has discussed each year with the actuary is that it is far more valuable to the system that the city continues to fund at that 27.5% rate. That's what's putting all the extra dollars into the system. And so we're just managing this discrepancy. I don't think that there's any damage to the system by the decisions that the city is making, because they are continuing to fund at that 27.5%.
Okay. Thank you.
And Joe?
I'm sure the city wouldn't mind if we try to bring down, I don't know how, its contribution. How do we go about doing that, since they are under separate sections of this document?
Well,
recommending, really.
Mm-hmm. And that's you'll remember from the last couple retreats, Dana talking about landing the plane, right? So when the actuary does the review every year, what we're going to do is use the funding policy, which the funding policy is separate from the code. So the code is what is the bare minimum required by the numbers. And then the funding policy is layered on top of that to set out the board's goal of getting to full funding. And so the funding policy is where the 27.5% contribution for the city comes into this conversation. And what Dana recommended and the board approved in October is that we start to ratchet that 27.5% down. I think it's 1% at a time as the funding is increasing. And that's why that's her analogy of landing the plane, so that the city's not staying at that 27.5% until all of a sudden you're fully funded and there's, you know, the contribution obligation drops to 15. So it is going to ratchet down if the system continues to perform as it has been. And that's about all the actuarial explanation I can probably handle. But
thank you. Thank you.
I think that opens up the potential for a separate conversation regarding the funding policy and what, or maybe not even in the funding, a separate policy on how much, I guess, reserves we need, so that because of the fluctuations in market, how much we would like to keep, or, you know, what's the triggers before the city rate goes down? How much do we need to have?
Yeah, Lisa, you might want to provide Sylvia with a copy of the amended funding policy that we did in October, because that starts to get into those issues as far as the triggers and what is our comfort level in reducing the city contribution. But I think, Sylvia, that Dana, the actuary, would say that this is going to be an ongoing annual discussion now as the funding status is improving and we get closer to that full funding target.
I do like that this language says that they can basically waive an increase rather than giving them kind of a full range of being able to decrease the contribution.
Right.
because what we don't want is that the employee contribution to be reduced kind of as a offset of, you know, a lack of compensation increase, for example, you know, over time or something to that effect. But yeah, I think this language is good. Any other discussion on this language? Can we entertain a motion to propose all three of these amendments?
So moved.
Thank you, Angel. Do we have a second? Thank you, Sylvia.
All right. Mark Rubin, absent. Dave Seymour, absent. John O'Hare.
Aye.
Terry Train, absent. Charlton Barron.
Aye.
Angel Osamalam.
Aye.
And Sylvia Amparano.
Aye.
Motion passed.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And then if I could, just for the board's update, we're going to package these three changes with the other pending changes the board has already approved, primarily relating to the restructuring of the disability benefits, and then get a package of code changes in front of the board. And Lisa, when that's submitted, if you would please let the board know, because there might be questions and discussion over some of those changes, because it's a combination of significant changes and then cleanup compliance type changes that won't get a lot of attention, but the disability changes might.
All right, we'll do.
Question. So do we need to wait until the disability changes are voted on, or the code has been revised before we take the full packet to Mayor and Council, or do we go with what we have now? I hope I'm not misunderstanding the process here.
So what we want to do is take everything to Mayor and Council at one time as a package. If the board has a disability application in the meantime, we would use the current code provisions that have not yet been updated. So we want to get those done before you have another application to review. And we've had a quiet period the last several months.
So my understanding is we've got that disability to work on. We'll wait until we get that done to take that packet to Mayor and Council. Is that correct?
The board has finished those provisions. Those are done.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So the package is ready to be taken to before Mayor and Council.
When these three changes are updated and the Mayor and Council communication is updated, it will be ready.
Mm-hmm. And do you normally attend these the meetings where code changes are on the Mayor and Council agenda?
I haven't in the last several years, but if you want me to, in this case, I will. I'm kind of the longest standing person involved in these changes right now because of the changes on the board. So if that would be helpful, I would be happy to.
Perfect. Thank you so much.
I think that would be good. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely want to maintain a good relationship with the Mayor and Council. Great. Administrative discussions. Lisa?
I don't have any.
Oh, okay. Call to the audience. Do you have any members of the audience that have any items? Okay, hearing none. Future agenda items. Anyone on the board? We are limited to cover what's on the agenda, so if you have a concern, I know discussion of the website and any other items that anyone would like to bring to the board?
Sure. I guess I would like maybe a communication plan on how we're communicating benefits to employees, what kind of, what do you call them? Information sessions we're doing with retirement planning, that kind of thing.
I can have that written out, yes. They do have a plan. Yes, okay.
So let's add that to the agenda for
administrative discussions.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay. Any other items, Angel?
I have a question for Lisa. I know when I first started with the city, new employees, there was a session provided by TSRS staff for That's new employees. Do we still do that?
Yes, no? Actually, Don, if you're still on, when is the date for the next one? The retirement seminar?
Oh, the retirement seminar is scheduled for July 7th, and I'll be sending out the email announcing that people can register for it. I have it in my calendar, so in June. Yes.
So we have
July.
The seminar itself is scheduled for July 7th, and I will be opening it up for registration next week on the 5th.
So how often are these seminars held? And the reason I'm asking, we have new employees coming on almost every day.
So that's what Sylvia was referring to, was she wanted a communication plan of how we are trying to expand our communication of what kind of retirement benefits we have, what's available to employees. So bringing back the retirement seminars, opening those back up is one of them. We also have, I also have my employees starting up a, we have one of our pension assistants working on a program where she's going to be working with younger employees, trying to get them into deferred comp and how it can benefit them. And we're working on different projects to try to expose employees on how their retirement works, 5 years, 10 years out, 5 years out, et cetera. So they'll have a handbook. We're working on lots of those things. And so
let me ask a question. Under Saxton, how often were these sessions held? Because I'm more concerned about new employees. Because I'd met two or three employees who did not enroll in TSRS because I think for appointed employees, they have to opt in. For regular employees, it's mandatory. You just pull them in. I don't know. But wouldn't we need to do that more often, possibly monthly? So new employees who come during a particular month would have that information on the retirement system. Yes, what you're talking about, my understanding, is for existing employees so they know what the whole process is, should they want to retire or what have you. But for the new employees coming in and wanting to take advantage of that system, I think we need to hold these seminars or these sessions monthly. Unless it was being done by Pete more frequently, I don't know. Don, you probably would know.
So thank you for sharing that concern. It's a great concern. Just as a matter of order, this will be an agenda item for the next meeting so that they can prepare the meeting packet with the info and have them good. So where we are in the agenda now is we're trying to determine what to cover in next meeting. So this will definitely be an area which multiple members of the board have expressed concern in. Don, did you have something to say before we ask for other items?
Yes. So it's a quick answer to Angel's question. There is a TSRS representative at almost every new employee orientation, and there are at least two of those a month.
Okay, great. So we'll get the deeper download on it. And you know, we're interested in hearing about the website, outreach efforts. I think just from the participation of the last election, we've seen, a good outreach and response. There's definitely interest. Mm-hmm. So let's hear about that next time. Any other items that we'd like to add for a future agenda from any member of the board?
Lisa? You can probably put the interviews on. We'll put interviews.
The interviews need to be added to that as well. And then
June or July.
If we can just get a report on the packet for mayor and council, maybe have the finished packet, mm-hmm. the full packet, for us to look at too. And the report on how that went, when that occurred, after that occurs. Any other items that we should?
Mr. Chair and Lisa, on the April agenda for future items is the climate action plan.
Excellent.
So I think we just don't want to lose track of that.
Okay. Yep. Thank you.
Excellent. Anything else? Well, appreciate all of your participation today, and looking forward to having your chair back next month. And thank you again, Craig and Callan, for sticking through the meeting with us, and wish you all the best of the rest of your month, and we'll see you next month.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Can I actually have a motion to adjourn?
Motion.
Okay, thank you. Sylvia, a second?
Second.
Thank you, Angel. I can call the...
Mark Rubin, absent. Dave Seymour, absent. John O'Hare.
Aye.
Terry Train, absent. Tarleton Farron.
Aye.
Angela Zaman.
Aye.
Sylvia Farrell.
Aye.
All right. We can call this meeting adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Why are we talking about the climate action plan for this?
Because
of the investments, I think.
It's direction from mayor and council mm-hmm. that we
oh, really?
Yeah. Look at it.
Yes, they're doing that now. Yeah.
That, I, we gotta be careful with that.